history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really need to be told, and we'll never hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. The goal is to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn an awful lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories of our greatest generation. And today I'm in Manteca, California, with 92-year-old Albert Mazzetti, Marine Corps veteran of World War II. We're going to hear about some of those Marine Corps days, but take me back to your childhood, Albert. One of six kids. Your parents were Italian-American immigrants. What are some of those earliest memories you have back home in Michigan?
Okay, thank you. We lived in a tenement, you know. My father, he used to work 5 miles down in the mines, the copper mines, you know. I can remember, if I may, we lived in the Italian section, you know what I mean? And the people really didn't like us. They were afraid of us being, you know, bad people. And they used to put signs up in the school, "Why don't you Dagos get your own school?" and things like that, you know. And so my parents used to say to me, "Don't say anything. You're there at school to steal your teacher's brains." My parents thought the teacher walked on water, you know. And they used to say, "Always go up at the front. Never take your eyes off your teacher. When your teacher walks in, you follow where your teacher is. Nobody's in that room but you and the teacher." You know what I mean? My parents, they couldn't write, they couldn't read, they never knew, but they were smart. You know, they knew about life. And so I can remember vividly, just to show you the kind of person I am, because I'm a very protective person. I was 8 years old, and remember, now when talking about the Great Depression, when there was no money, a penny was a lot of money, and a nickel, wow. My brothers and I, three of us slept in the bed, my three brothers and I, one bed. My sister's the same way, and we had one faucet that was cold water. The toilet was down at the end of the hall, you know, and on and on and on. That's the way it was. Nobody had anything. I can remember when we needed meat, you know, to make spaghetti, I put crumbs out in the back, you know, and I put a box with a piece of wood underneath it, and I'd tie a string to it, and I hide behind a tree, and when the sparrows went underneath the box to get the crumbs, I would pull it, and I'd get myself 6 or 10 sparrows, and I'd kill them and clean them up and give them to my mother, and that was the meat that we had for our spaghetti. I mean, nobody had anything. I mean, really, Paul. But anyway, I made a box. I was 8 years old. I made a square box, you know, out of wood. And I used to go all over, "Shine, sir, shine, sir, shine, sir." And sometimes they'd say, "Get out of here, kid," or, yeah, I'd go into bars, everything, you name it. I would go down to the Chronicle office. My corner was the National Lumberman's Bank on the corner. And I would go to the Chronicle, and I'd buy a bunch of newspapers, 5, 10 newspapers for a penny apiece, okay? And then I would go to the National Lumberman's Bank, and I would stand on the corner, 8 years old, and this is what I would yell. Ernie Coelho, read all about it. And then I'd read the headline. That was and the people would say, they'd give me 2 pennies for the newspaper, you know. And then at night, I'd put the pennies in the kitchen from my mother, you know, whatever I got, you know. So this one day, to show you how protective I am, I heard a noise outside, you know, and I looked out the window, and one of my friends who was, you would call now eighth or ninth grader, and there was a little black kid, and he had his aunt, was pushing the kid, and I told him, and I yelled at him in Italian, told him, "Leave him alone." And so I went down there. I said, "Leave him alone." And remember, no, there were no streets. This was dirt, sand, and the milkman had a wagon that he pulled. And the horses knew where to go, and the milkman would just go in the house with his milk, and there were no refrigerators. It were ice boxes. We didn't even know what a refrigerator was. Well, they did. There were no refrigerators then. There were ice boxes. And so then the iceman, the same way, we would follow him on, and he would chip off ice for us on his wagon, you know, and the And then he said, you can have the chips, you know. So he would take a big 25 pounds of ice on a big leather thing, and he would walk in the house, you know, and put it in the ice box and leave, you know. Nobody, what are you doing in my house? Nothing like that, you know what I mean? So getting back to this little boy, I went down there, and I told him, I said, leave him alone. So then he pushed me. I ran into the house in the basement. I pulled my uncle's sword out. He would, in the 1917 war he was in, his sword was in the basement. I pulled that sword out, and I go running after this guy. This, my friend, and it's a good thing he was taller than me and he had long legs. And I ran. There were no streets. There were alleys, dirt alleys. And here I am trying to kill this guy with his sword, you know, well, to get him. And my mother yells at me, Mukefai, you know, venga casa, you know, come home. What are you doing in this shit? Alberto, venga casa, you know. So, and then I told her, I said, what he did? She said, you know, put that sword away, you know. So I took the little boy by his hand, a little black kid by his hand. I took him down in the railroad town where all the big trains came in and all that. And I took him to a store, and he said, yeah, he said, Albert, I'll see that he gets home. I said, thank you. From then time on, I knew that I am very, very protective. That's why I am what I am, because God made me this way, and I have no fear. I mean, you know, I gave my life to my Savior when I was 15 years old. I was old enough to pull my own pants on. I was a man, see, because the first thing you ask him is, do you put your own pants on? Who puts your pants on for you? And that's, are you a man, yes or no? You know what I mean? So from then on in, you know, Paul, it's easy for me to protect anybody. I'm good with my dukes, you know, and I'm a protector. I'm a servant of the public, and I'm a protector of the public, and I have no fear for nobody.
Well, and you mentioned you can handle your dukes. How old were you when you started boxing, and how good were you?
Well, that's a different thing. You know, we used to go to the pool hall. What was his name? The Italian guy had, there was a pool hall, and all of the big gangsters, if you will, you know, used to be in the back, you know, like you see in the movies.
The mafia.
Yeah. What they would do is they would, come on, Albert, you want to earn $5? You know, $5. And so that's where I got my, you know, and I fought for the mafia.
So you earned money. You were the entertainment for the mobsters who were betting on your fights.
That's right.
So what kind of people would you fight, and how did that go? How'd you do?
You name it, I did it. Yeah. Anybody. I don't care who they are. Bring them on. In fact, big guys like you, it's easy for me with big guys like you because I move so fast. And they say, where the hell is Albert, where are you? Here I am, bam, bam, bam. You know, like when I was training my men to box, yeah, there were big guys like you. You know, they were, wrestling is different than boxing. In boxing, and I'm not talking about boxing like you see in television, biting and kicking and all that. I'm talking about Marcus of Queensberry rules. You got to outsmart your opponent as well as to outpoint him and all that stuff. And whereas in wrestling, my men could just grab a hold of me and tear me apart, but not in boxing, you know what I mean? Because they couldn't find me, you know what I mean? But I love my men.
Sticking with the boxing theme, did you have a boxer at the time, a famous boxer who you kind of looked up to or you emulated your game after?
Well, to me, it was money. I mean, you know, I did it for money. I mean, to stay alive, you know, and to give the money to my parents, because some of the guys used to stick up and I didn't want any part of that, you know what I mean? Or they'd do bad things and I never wanted any part of that. So I did that. I did what God offered me and I was good. I was good with my hands. I was quick. Even right now. I mean, I think that article says that. I tell about how I go to dances and women love it. I'm like Fred Astaire, and I'm 92 years old. I don't understand it. Honest to God, Paul, why am I like this? I mean, why me? Well, I don't know. God's got a plan for me. I mean, I think I'm going to live forever or something like that.
Well, maybe you should tell our audience what you do every morning. How do you start your day?
Every morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, I strap on my gun, and I take a flashlight, because, I mean, it's dark here, and I'm gone. See, it's like this. I live here. And I run 3 miles around like this, and I come back. And I'm not puffing hard or nothing. I mean, I don't understand it.
So you run 3 miles, and you're not talking about walking. You're talking about running 3 miles every day.
Oh, I run. Oh, yeah. Can you see me walking?
No, but I could see you competing in some, you know, Golden Age games or something. I bet you'd fare pretty well against other 90-year-olds. Well, tell me this. If you can go back to to those childhood days. Six kids in the family.
Oh, yeah.
What was little Albert dreaming about? What were your ambitions? What did you think you wanted to do someday?
I knew that I wanted to be a protector. The Marine Corps was good for me because I could protect and not be admonished for it. I mean, you know, look at what we did in the Second World War and in the Korean War. I mean, my protections were legitimate. I've never dishonored my name, Paul, and nothing. You know what I mean? So I love America. My parents love America. I love America right now. I fought in three wars, so I loved America so much.
Well, tell me how you found out on December 7th. How did you find out about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
Well, it was a newspaper. I would go down, buy a newspaper for a penny.
Yeah. So you were the kid on the corner.
I was the kid on the corner.
Saying Pearl Harbor's been bombed?
About Lumberman's Bank. Everybody wanted that corner on the National Lumberman's Bank. They tried to take it away from me. Now, remember, I'm just a little kid. You know what I did? I got rocks, and I had us gunny sack. In those days, there was no such thing as a, you know, like what we were now. It was gunny sack. I put those rocks in that gunny sack, and the big guys kind of come and said, get off this corner. I let them have it. 1, 2, 3. They left me alone from then on.
You threw the rocks at them?
Oh, I swung it like it was a, I was right up where I could get to them with it, you know?
Oh, you swung the sack full of rocks and hit them with it.
Oh, yeah.
But
like
when
a matador in the ring, you know, with a sword.
Well, the sword was another story. Did that sink in, though, when you're saying, you know, you're yelling to people to buy this newspaper, but the headline is Oahu has been bombed, Pearl Harbor's been hit, the fleet has been decimated. Did that mean something to you? Did it bother you?
Well, it you know, I was just a kid. I mean, I was 16, 17, something like that. And so it meant something to me. That's a good question, because I have a lot of this. And I have a lot of this, see, and I'm pointing at my heart. I have a lot of that. Thank God I do, because if I didn't have a lot of that and I had a lot of this, I wouldn't make it in life, because you can't do it. See, that's what Donald's problem is. He's too harsh. And I would tell him, come on, Donald. You should have two veins. You should have a vinegar vein and a blood vein, you know? And one side of you is mean, the other side of you is nice and compassionate. And otherwise, if you're got both veins are harsh, you're not going to do right by people. I couldn't go around. People were afraid of me because I was a boxer, but I didn't go around and, you know, walk on the other side of the street. No, I love you. You know what I mean?
Well, we know he loves his country and he risked his life to defend her. And I kind of have a feeling that Donald Trump may turn into a recurring theme today. Albert Mazzetti says he actually would love President Trump's job. He has written multiple letters to the president with Albert's ideas for what might help, and he's even invited him to his ranch in Manteca, California to talk things over. On the surface, that might sound a little far-fetched to some of us, but I can tell you that Albert Mazzetti is 100% serious about it, just as he was for running for governor in California. Not only was the name Albert Caesar Mazzetti on the June primary ballot as one of 12 Democratic candidates for the state's highest office, there were 27 candidates listed in total, and with 11,064 votes, this 92-year-old World War II veteran finished ahead of 11 of them. He has some very strong opinions about the frontrunner, which I'm sure he'd be more than happy to share with you if you ever experienced Albert's firm handshake. But we're going to try to focus on his Marine Corps experience in World War II when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have got gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where you never really know what you're going to hear, right? I mean, we have heard some incredible stories, and the sources of those stories really cover the entire spectrum, from a political standpoint, from a personality standpoint. Some of them end up very reluctant to discuss the things they went through all those years ago in World War II. And in those cases, we really have to be patient as we mine through levels of those memories. Others tend to be a little more forthcoming. And our guest today, Albert Mazzetti, tends to be one of those guys who is as candid as can be. He's never going to leave you wondering where he stands on an issue. Born in Muskegon, Michigan, to parents who had immigrated from Italy, Albert was one of three brothers to serve in our armed forces during World War II. We're going to dive into his Marine Corps experience in a moment. And really, it's kind of out of the ordinary for Albert to look back in time because he's so busy looking forward. A longtime school teacher and administrator who will tell you he has a doctorate in behavioral science, he has also been in law enforcement. He's held elected office. He once served on the city council in Manteca, California, where he's lived for quite a few decades now. And yes, he'll be the first to tell you that he's disappointed he did not win California's recent primary election for governor, but he's proud that he did garner more than 11,000 votes. Even at age 92, he's thinking about running for office in the future, and if you don't take him seriously on account of his age, he'll invite you to run 3 miles with him every morning, or try another daily routine that you can see for yourself at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We've heard from quite a few Marines here over the years. We've heard about some of their most brutal battles in the Pacific during World War II. More than 24,000 U.S. Marines were killed in less than 4 years. 68,000 more were wounded in action. And of course, there were emotional and psychological wounds as well. We'll get to that. But let's start at the beginning of that Semper Fi story, back to that teenager in Michigan. What was it, Albert, that made you want to join the Marine Corps?
First of all, the Marine Corps was, you know, the elite, mm-hmm. the greatest, you know what I mean? And five of us went down. Some of my friends, big, handsome guys like you, but they used to smoke and drink and all that, and I never did any of that kind of stuff. When we went to dances, I used to dance, and they'd sit around, play cards and smoke and all that. You know what I mean? Not me. They flunked out. I was the only one the Marine Corps took. Uh-huh. It was me, little Albert.
And were your brothers already in the service at this time?
Yeah. My brother Leon was already in, and my brother Robert was in. Mm-hmm.
How do you think your mother felt having three boys going off to war?
That's a good question, you know. But she had it in her. She was strong. We had the star in the window. They gave us a star to put on the window.
So she had three blue stars flying there, but I'm sure there were some times where she came close to having to switch one to a gold star. Probably just in your story alone, I'm sure you had some close calls.
Oh,
but
yeah.
What do you remember about the way they made you a Marine, the way they turned this kid into a Marine?
Well, first of all, when I shot my first Japanese soldier, he tried to kill me, and then he missed, and I killed him. I almost couldn't take that. And my men said to me, "Sarge, he tried to kill you." Then I realized, you know, that, yeah, this is war. From then on, it was 17 years old, kill, 18 years old, kill, 19, 20, kill, kill, kill. And it was war. And that's the way it was.
And you were with the 4th Marine Division.
Well, I was with the 4th. It depends on where they... See, we were secure troops. We were machine gunners. Wherever we were needed. I never saw Betty Hutton, nor any of the movie stars. Why? Because I was fighting somebody. And that's the way it was. We were always in demand, you know. And 4th Marine Division, 22nd Marines, 24th Marines, 26th Marines, 5th Temporary with Colonel Chesty Puller. And... it depended where we were needed, you know what I mean? But for some of the Marines, you know, some of them, it was hard because they're like some of the battles that were fought, you know, that more severe than any of the other ones, you know. But it was a job we had to do, and we did it. And and we never complained about it. Yeah, but how come you're calling us here? We just came on, you know? No, you never heard us say that. Never heard us say that.
And so your job was with a machine gun squad?
Machine gun. The 30 caliber ones.
So how would that work operationally? Walk us through maybe a battle that you were in and how that unfolded, what you were faced with and what you had to do.
It depends. Now you're asking me, what's war like, Albert? When people ask me what it's like in war, you got to be in war, and then you don't, you know. But to tell somebody, you can tell them, well, I can tell you, okay, when we were on Guam, I had 13 men behind me, and we were going up a trail, and it was through the jungle, and I hear this little boy yelling, "Hey, Marine, hey, Marines!" And I went over there, and I looked over there, I told my men to wait, and I looked over there, and there was a cave there. And this little boy was standing out in front of the cave. Remember now, Guam was owned by the United States. It was the only island that I fought on that was really, it was Americans' possession that the Japs had taken over. He yelled at, you know, a little boy, 10 years old, you know? Oh, God, you're opening my brain up. I haven't said these things in a million years. So anyway, I said, what's the matter? And he was talking English to me. Mm-hmm. He said, my mother and father, and remember, America owned that island.
Yeah.
So he said, there's 4 Japanese soldiers in there that want to give up. And there's a Japanese nurse, and she's there, and we're all hungry, and we haven't eaten, you know, they're afraid to come out. I said, okay, do you speak Japanese? The only thing I know is, you know, come out your hands, do not be afraid. And he said, yes, when he would know, you know, because being raised by the Japanese, you know, there. And so he said, yeah. I said, well, this is what you do. You go back in the cave, you tell them to get naked, leave their guns on the ground, and then when they come out, you come out, your mom and, oh, did I tell you his mom and dad were in there? Oh, his mother and father were in there too. And you tell your mom and dad to come out, you tell the nurse to come out, and then the last ones that come out will be the 4 Japanese soldiers because we'll be ready for them, see? And they've got to be naked with their hands up in the air. He said, okay. So he went in and blah, 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 you know, he did his magic, you know, and well, you know, pretty soon he comes out, his parents come out, Hatsuko, her name was, I haven't said that in a million years. Beautiful. Little Japanese nurse. Then the guys were standing there. I said, okay, tell them to come out. I said to my men, all right, dump all your food, your sea rations, on the ground here. They're hungry, and they're going to take all of our sea rations. So my men dumped all their food out, and I told my radio man, I called the beach. I said, send a shore patrol up here because we got 4 prisoners for them. And they said, okay, Sergeant. So here come these Japanese, and they were naked. And so I told him, tell them to turn around. He blah, blah, blah. And he turns them around. Nothing. They were okay. I said, okay, fine. Tell them to get dressed. They got dressed. And I said, okay, tell them to sit down here. And I said, okay, you men, give them all the food. And they did. They gave them all the food. And then the shore patrol came up and took them. And Hatsuko, I used to go see Hatsuko. When she was in the woman's part of the camp, you know, prison camp where they were. And I would bring her food. And then one day she wasn't there. And that was it. But I'll never forget her. Beautiful Japanese girl.
I've got to ask you, yes. As you described that scenario, and you took precautions making them strip their uniforms off in case they had something on them.
Oh, yeah.
But were you concerned about a booby trap, an ambush, anything
always,
like that?
Always, always, always. But I was equally concerned. Some of the Marines used to, if they wounded a Japanese soldier, they would prop them up against a coconut tree and torture them or knock their teeth out. Their rifle butts, you know, to get the gold teeth and that. I never allow my men to do stuff like that. Killing them, that's fine. But all this other torture and all that stuff, no.
Have you ever wondered what happened to that young boy who helped negotiate that handoff?
Yes, he's a little Guamanian boy, Spanish, because Spain for 500 years owned all that land. But yeah. Oh, I know what I forgot to tell you. The father went out and he came back, and he had an octopus with him about this big. And we had octopus sitting right there. We made a fire. He made a fire, his wife, you know, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's, I ate octopus. All of my men and I ate octopus.
So you had given them all your sea rations. So in you know, a gesture of gratitude, he went out and caught an octopus?
That's true. Yes. He said, you have ever had octopus? I didn't know what octopus, you know, octopus, what's that?
But he knew where to find it, obviously.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It didn't take him long, boy. I mean, you know, he was built. He's just Guamanian.
Well, I've heard a lot of stories from World War II. I've never heard one about the celebratory octopus.
How about that?
And I know you were involved in a lot of battles and some other battles where a lot of Americans, a lot of Marines were killed. What do you remember about Saipan?
Saipan was, we took over for reserve, you know, we were reserve. Well, Tinian was just off to the right of it. So it was Saipan, Tinian, Guam. So I fought on all three of those islands. But what I remember of Saipan is the Japanese, they were pushed up against where the cliffs were, you know, high, and the mothers would just throw their babies over onto the rocks because they were told that we Marines would eat them, that we would just kill them and eat them. They really believed that we were that way, that we were that crass, you know, that, and we had people, intelligence, you know, people from the beach. They put up big speakers and they spoke in Japanese, you know, to them, you know, give up, you know, don't believe all this nonsense, you know, and so forth. But it didn't do any good. They kept jumping over the side of the cliff, and you know, that was sad. Their kids, even their kid, the mothers would throw their children down there.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who were on Saipan and saw that and witnessed that.
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't know how I would handle that. And I also wonder how that made you feel about the enemy. If the enemy would tell that kind of propaganda to cost innocent lives the way it was happening there.
I know, but, you know, we saw movies where the Japs would go to, they took over China. Remember the one he shot, the Chinese boy? He went up to his head, you know, the Japanese. And so we knew the Japanese were cruel. And they were. They were very cruel. But we weren't. We did our job. And the job was to kill them. And that was what we had to do.
And you guys are killing some of them, but they're killing some Marines. A lot of Marines. Yes. Thousands of Marines. Yes. I'm sure.
Was it the Army? Didn't they were in the Philippines, and they had a march.
Yeah, the Bataan Death March.
Thank you. Yeah, see.
Well, I'm curious, though, for you, because you were in a lot of these battles.
19 jungle islands, yeah.
So I'm just guessing that there had to have been circumstances where you saw guys who you'd gotten to know, who you trusted, who you counted on, who got killed.
I had them in my arms. They would yell at me, "Sarge, I've been hit, I've been hit." I would go over to them, I'd look at them, the first thing they'd say is, "Am I going to die, Sarge?" And I'd look at him and say, "Nah, you're going to be in a week, you'll be back on the line." Or I would tell him, "Yes, you're going to die. But I'm going to tell you something," I would say to him. "I'm going to write your mother a letter, and I'm going to tell her what a hero you were." And I did. Every one of my men. And then we'd have to go on. Then when they would get so many Marines that they had to put them overboard, you know, they would have the sergeants who, wherever the unit was, they'd take us aboard of a ship, and they would do the funeral routine, and they would tip them over, you know, and down they'd go.
And you mentioned writing those letters to their families.
Yep.
And I don't know if you have an exact count, but it just makes me wonder, how many times do you think you had to do that?
Many, many, yeah. Too many.
And how old were you?
Well, 18, 19. I can remember, I didn't remember what island it was on. The officer was giving me instructions, and he was a big, tall guy like you. And I was looking off to my left while he was talking to me and giving me instructions. And there were two dead Marines in the water. And the water was going like this, you know, up and back. And they were their floating bodies were going up and back. I'll never forget that. That's why I cried, I guess.
Yeah. You know? Well, we're going to talk about those tears. And I've got to wonder, if you were in action that many times for that amount of time.
Always. None of us, my units, saw any Hollywood stars come. You know how they show on the movies?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you see Betty Hutton and Bob Hope and all. No, no.
But
nothing like that.
I wonder, were there times where you're sitting there, exhausted, worn out, probably hungry, dirty as all get out, maybe bloody too, and you're thinking, am I going to wake up tomorrow?
No.
Am I going to survive this?
No.
Did you ever wonder about
Never.
That?
Never. I was always alive, always alert. My senses were always, you know, 10-10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh no, I used to sleep with my revolver. I have my 45 in the, I sleep with my head, you know, in the foxhole, in my hand. Mm-hmm. Oh no, 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 no. There, nobody was going to catch me asleep.
What about, as you look back now, and it's been, you know, 75 years, are there some moments, some instances within all those battles where you look back and say, Boy, that was close. That could have been it for me.
Oh, yeah. But if I may, let me reference, because it really bothers me, this school policeman who didn't react, you know, when the crazy guy was shooting. What was that, Parkland School or something like that? But anyway, I wrote a letter about the kids, the way they reacted and all that. And I told him, I said, you should be embarrassed. I said, you know, first of all, you never hear a Marine say that there's somebody else that's a coward. Never call anybody a coward. There have been times, and I told him, there were times when my hands were like this, and I could see the enemy coming, and I couldn't do anything. Because I must have been so afraid. And then my mind kicked in, and then I grabbed, and then I opened up on it. But so was I a hero, or was I a coward? You know what I mean? So no, you don't do that. Marines don't talk like that. It's only civilians that talk like that. You know, he didn't go in there how about he was protecting you for 30 years. I wrote a letter to those kids. I wanted to go on CNN and talk to the kids and tell the kids how wrong they were. Because I would never, as a sergeant, would I say to my men, you're a coward. You just don't talk like that.
It's break time again, but I think you're getting the idea that 92-year-old Albert Mazzetti is very tuned in to current events. I'm sure we'll hear more of that, and we'll also try to explore more of his perspective from being a Marine machine gunner in World War II. You can find photos of Albert as a teenage Marine, as well as a fit and trim 92-year-old if you pull up Hometown Heroes on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a colorful and wide-ranging visit today with a spirited nonagenarian named Albert Mazzetti. Born in Michigan, he has spent most of his adult life in California, where he just ran for governor. And he'll tell you he's only 12 years older than the current occupant of that office, Jerry Brown. Albert has been a school teacher, an administrator, a police officer, a city councilman, but he wouldn't have had the opportunity to take on any of those challenges if he had not survived some major battles in the Pacific as a Marine machine gunner. We've heard some of his memories from battles like Guam and Saipan, two of the 19 different Pacific islands he set foot on during World War II. And as we hear some of those opinions that he holds so strongly, perhaps you'll agree, perhaps you'll disagree, but let's all remember that Albert, like so many other young Americans in World War II, put his life on the line so all of us would have the freedom and liberty to express our opinions. And I'd like to hear a little more about those experiences in the Marines. I've never been in combat. Most of the people listening have never been in these situations. Can you give us an example of a moment where you think, you know, I was this close? That could have ended it for me.
All I can say is, in combat, God's either with you or luck is with you, you know? Because I've had guys right next to me drop dead, you know, or get seriously wounded. Why wasn't it me? Why you? Sure, you're always asking that question. You know, or an ambush, you know, you get ambushed. Yeah. When I was 17, I killed that Japanese soldier. Why didn't he shoot at one of my men? Why did he shoot at me? You know what I mean? Sure. Oh, yes. That's a good question. Oh, yeah. So I don't know. You can either say God was on my side or I was lucky. And I prefer to say that God's was on my side.
What about the end of the war? Was that big news for you to hear the Japanese had surrendered?
Not really. The job was more important. I mean, I had a job to do. And, you know, to come, hey, you're nice going. For what? I did my duty. I did what had to be done. I don't belong to any vets organization. I tried. Yeah. But I go in there and they're all they're doing is playing cards and they're smoking and drinking. And I don't do those things, you know. I want to do something where I can help somebody. I don't, you know, I want to be me. And I'm not denigrating what right. they do, but it's just I wouldn't be comfortable. First of all, I don't smoke. I never smoked. I don't drink. I don't even know what alcohol tastes like. I don't want to because I know that I might like it, and I don't want to like it. Because I know that as a police officer, I picked up little kids in the street. Their fathers have been drunk. They killed their kids, and their father's drunk and with their mother in the car, and I'm picking their little child up. Of it. You know what I mean? So I've been through that. You name it, I've done it.
Well, and I think people would be interested to hear, because there is certainly a parallel with our veterans who are coming home today. Maybe the understanding was different 70 years ago than it is now. But when you came home from the war, it wasn't just snap your fingers and jump back into action. Tell me what you went through when you got home.
Well, as I say, I sat for 3 weeks and I cried all day. I couldn't stop and I didn't know what I was crying about. To this day, I don't know what I was crying about. I mean, I thank God for God's taking care of me. I could have now that I know, you know, that they've given it a name and all that. It could have gone the other way and I could end up in the toilet or something, you know, or taking drugs or something. But it never happened to me, thank God.
What finally got you through that, got you over it or past it?
Well, I fall back on the fact that God must have a plan for me, because I'm amazed that even the way I am now, I'm almost 100 years old. And women, I'm telling you, we go to dances, they think I'm 40 years old. And I can do anything. Is there going to come a day when I'm going to be like this, you know? I don't know. Maybe. I don't see myself that way. I want to be the president of the United States of America, because America needs a lot of help. And I want to help Donald. It just hurts. It breaks my heart that Donald isn't sitting here. You know, if he comes here, I'm going to ask you to come too, because you ask a lot of good questions. You're the kind of guy, you're not an I, me person, are you? No, you're a we, us person. But see, most people, you know, what can I get out of it? You know, what's in it for me?
It strikes me that if that had been the collective mentality during World War II, that we probably wouldn't be speaking English right here.
Correct.
Right.
See, you're too quick. I can't think that fast. Yeah.
Well, you know, and let me ask you this. You know, you mentioned a name in there that I think people who've studied World War II, they've heard. And over time, he's come to almost epitomize the picture of a Marine. Like if you see a Marine's picture on the wall, it's probably Chesty Puller that scowl on his face. It's famous guy.
Tough guy.
And you actually spent some time around him?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Everybody. All Marines know Chesty Puller.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, what kind of guy was he if you were
him? He was about my size, only he was built like a... I mean, he was built... His frame, see, my frame isn't big. His frame was big, like yours.
What about his personality? How did he treat you?
Oh, he was a good guy, but I mean, you know, everybody knew Chesty Puller.
You hear a lot of things about Marines. Once a Marine, always a Marine. They talk about Semper Fi, Semper Fidelis, always faithful. What about you? What does it mean to you? What has it meant to you for these last 75 years to be a Marine? How would you define what a Marine really is?
That's a good question. The reason it's a good question is I'm an old-time Marine. A big, handsome guy like you, to be a Marine, and there were a lot of you in the Marine Corps, big like you, you know? I don't know how you would see it, but first of all, you got to be protective. I don't care. You can be bigger, smaller, or short, or fat, or thin, or whatever. You've got to have a protective tendency, and you've got to be a servant of the public. Those are tantamount to success, because if you're not, then you're not going to be a good Marine, because that's what Marines do. They protect, and they're servants of the public, and that's all they are. Since time immemorial, Marines have been that way.
Have you ever been to the Marine Corps Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery, the big Iwo Jima statue?
No.
There's a quote on there. It's from Admiral Nimitz, and it says, "Among the Marines in the Pacific War," you've probably heard this quote, "uncommon valor was a common virtue."
That's true. That's why we never call anybody a coward. Never call it, because you just never know. You just do your job.
Are there some Marines you served with or you remember that you think really epitomize that, that you look back on and say, those guys are my heroes?
All of them. When I was in the Marine Corps, that's the way the Marine Corps was. And that's the way the Marine Corps should be. And I'm going to tell you something. There's an article in the paper. They want old-time Marines. I'm thinking of throwing my hat in the ring.
You want to re-enlist at 92?
I don't know. I'm going to ask them. I've got it. It's right here. The Marines, they need guys like me that have been through it.
Well, you run 3 miles a day. You probably pass the physical,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. So I don't know what I'm going to do, but I brought the newspaper home because thank that's you. Me.
I didn't ask you, are there any medals, decorations I should know about?
Oh, yeah. Well, the one that we laugh about is I was top shooter in the battalion, you know, little old Albert, you know, and they had 500 Marines out there on the blacktop, and the general comes out with a big medal, and he calls me out, you know, Sergeant Albert Mazzetti, yes, you know, and pins that medal on me and all that, you know. I don't go for that stuff. I don't go. I have them all, and I wear them all and all that, but I don't need it. I know who I am.
Well, speaking of, at 92, almost 93, what would you say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
That's a good question. I'm thankful that that I am who I am. I've never done anything wrong or never dishonored my name. And I've dedicated myself, with God's help, to make this a better world, to make this a place for people to feel secure. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that no one harms our great democracy that America is. They left Italy to come here. Just imagine, and the people that come here, because America is America. America's, look at the people that come from Mexico. And then that's another thing I'm going to take up with Donald. Donald, you know, send me back, because I'm here because I'm an immigrant, you know, Donald. So go easy, Donald. Go easy.
For those of us today who didn't live through World War II and that time in our history, what do you think is the most important lesson that we can learn from those of you who did and everything that you guys went through during that time?
Be good to each other. Be kind. Don't worry if a person is a Muslim or a Christian or, you know, those things don't matter. They don't matter. I mean, you know, God made those people just like he made you and me. And I see myself as father of all of the people. If I was the governor of California, I would tell them, you're my children, and I'm going to take care of you. You know what I mean? And I would. And that's why if I run for president of the United States, and I think I tell Donald that, don't I? Something like that, that act like a father to these people, you know, Donald, you know.
I got to, there's one thing I can't forget to say. I got to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country.
Well,
thank you for telling us about it.
I did my duty.
Yeah, is there anything else you think we ought to know?
Help me to become president of the United States of America, because I think America needs me.
I don't know if we can find you enough votes for that, but, you know, you could have a free flight to Washington, D.C. to see the National World War II Memorial because of Honor Flight, if you're interested in that.
Let me do this. Let me, as president of the United States of America, go look at that memorial. We'll go together. How's that?
Well, maybe we'll take you there and we'll see if Donald can come out and say hello.
That wouldn't be bad. Yeah. If you can get Donald here, I just think you're wonderful. Try, will you?
Well, we might have to take you to D.C. to do it.
Donald's got he's got Air Force One. He could come here and
yeah, that's true.
And he could bring his family. And it would be, you know, he doesn't have to be afraid to come to here. I'm not going to hurt anybody.
Well, all you can do is keep extending that invitation. Our 45th president has a reputation of being a little unpredictable, so you never know, right? If he does end up in Manteca, California one of these days, perhaps we'll have Albert Mazzetti to thank for that. Before we wrap up, there's one more thing I'd like to address, and it has to do with our 33rd president and how a decision that he had to make affected the life of Albert Mazzetti and the rest of our military in 1945, not to mention the rest of the world. You've probably heard quite a few of his predecessor FDR's speeches, but have you ever heard President Harry Truman addressing the nation after deciding to deploy atomic weaponry against Imperial Japan? Well, I know I never had, so I thought I'd share some of that with you before talking to Albert about the impact of that decision. Here's President Truman on August 9th, 1945.
My fellow Americans, I have just returned from Berlin, the city from which the Germans intended to rule the world. It is a ghost city. The buildings are in ruins. Its economy and its people are in ruins. War has indeed come home to Germany, and to the German people. It has come home in all the frightfulness with which the German leaders started and waged it. The German people are beginning to atone for the crimes of the gangsters whom they placed in power and whom they wholeheartedly approved and obediently followed. We also saw some of the terrific destruction which the war had brought to the occupied countries of Western Europe and to England. How glad I am to be home again, and how grateful to Almighty God the land of ours has been spared. We must do all we can to spare her from the ravages of any future breach of the peace. That is why, though the United States wants no territory or profit or selfish advantages out of this war, we are going to maintain the military bases necessary for the complete protection of our interests and of world peace. No one can foresee what another war would mean to our own cities and our own people. What we are doing to Japan now, even with the new atomic bomb, is only a small fraction of what would happen to the world in a third world war. That is why the United Nations are determined that there shall be no next war. That is why the United Nations are determined to remain united and strong. We can never permit any aggressor in the future to be clever enough to divide us or strong enough to defeat us. That will be the guiding spirit in the peace settlements to come. The results of the Berlin Conference have been published. The conference was concerned with many political and economic questions, but there was one strictly military matter uppermost in the minds of the American delegates. It was the winning of the war against Japan. On our program, that was the most important item. The military arrangements made at Berlin were, of course, secret. One of those secrets was revealed yesterday when the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. The Soviet Union, before she had been informed of our new weapon, agreed to enter the war in the Pacific. We gladly welcome into this struggle against the last of the Axis aggressors, our gallant and victorious ally against the Nazis. The Japs will soon learn some more of the military secrets agreed upon at Berlin. They will learn them firsthand, and they will not like them. The British, Chinese, and United States governments have given the Japanese people adequate warning of what is in store for them. We have laid down the general terms on which they can surrender. Our warning went unheeded. Our terms were rejected. Since then, the Japanese have seen what our atomic bomb can do. They can foresee what it will do in the future. The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in the first attack to avoid, in so far as possible, the killing of civilians. But that attack is only a warning of things to come. If Japan does not surrender, bombs will have to be dropped on her war industries, and unfortunately, thousands of civilian lives will be lost. I urge Japanese civilians to leave industrial cities immediately and save themselves from destruction. I realize the tragic significance of the atomic bomb. Its production and its use were not lightly undertaken by this government, but we knew that our enemies were on the search for it. We know now how close they were to finding it, and we knew the disaster which would come to this nation and to all peace-loving nations, to all civilization, if they had found it first. That is why we felt compelled to undertake the long and uncertain and costly labor of discovery and production. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. Having found the bomb, we have used it. We have used it against those who attack us without warning at Pearl Harbor, against those who have starved and beaten and executed American prisoners of war, against all pretense of obeying international laws of warfare. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
Harry Truman deciding to deploy that atomic bomb, do you think it saved your life?
I know it did, because you know it's very profound that you would ask me that question, because on the few days before the bomb was dropped, we got word, the 2nd Marine Division, we were going to be the initial landing on Kyushu. Kyushu is the mainland of Japan. And we were told that you're not going to make it this time, you guys, because we're going to be in the homeland. And they're going to kill, for the first 2 hours, there's going to be about 100% casualty. And so I wrote my mother, and I told her, I said, Mother, I said, I've been lucky so far, but we're not going to be lucky this time, you know. And she prayed for me, and of course, you know, and I prayed, and thank God Truman dropped the bomb. He saved my life, and he saved all the Marines' life, because the trying to take the homeland away from the Japanese would be an impossible task for the first couple of hours. We would eventually do that, but for the first 2 hours, it would be just mayhem. And there's no way anybody, no Marine would live through it. In fact, we were told that. So thank God for the atomic bomb.
And of course, we will continue to hope and pray no commander-in-chief ever has to make that decision again. We're out of time, but I bet you heard a few things you hadn't heard before over this last hour. I know I did. Thanks again to Albert Mazzetti and to a Hometown Heroes listener named April for letting us know about his story. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time as we are reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.